This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton. The U.S. Justice Department said on Monday it would work toward providing families of victims of the September 11, 2001 terror attacks with more information about events leading up to the attacks as part of a federal lawsuit that aims to hold the Saudi government accountable. It follows longstanding criticism from relatives of those killed, accusing the U.S. government of withholding crucial details from them. Almost 2,000 families, victims, and first responders objected in a letter last week to President Joe Biden's attendance at September 11th memorial events if key documents remain classified. The Saudi government has long denied any connection to the attacks, which killed thousands of Americans. U.S. officials have investigated ties between Saudi nationals and some of the airplane hijackers, but have not established that its government was directly involved. North Korea has condemned U.S.-South Korea military exercises that begin this week, saying the drills show the need for Pyongyang to develop more of its own military capabilities. The South Korean news agency said the U.S. and South Korea on Tuesday kicked off preliminary training ahead of the annual summer military drills. The exercises are being scaled back because of the coronavirus pandemic, and also caution against upsetting North Korea, which recently hinted it is interested in dialogue with South Korea. But the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said on Tuesday that Pyongyang views the exercises as an act of aggression, no matter what size or form they take. From Washington, you're listening to VOA News. A Haitian justice official has told AP that he has selected a judge to oversee the case of the slaying of President Jovenel Moïse in July. The decision comes amid concerns over death threats and demands for additional security. Magistrate Bernard Saint-Ville said Monday that Matthew Chanlat will be in charge of overseeing proceedings involving the murder of the president July 7th. The magistrate said last week that he had requested extra security measures as he prepared to select the judge to oversee the case. Death threats are especially common in high-profile slayings in Haiti. Several court clerks probing the president's assassination have already gone into hiding. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador said he and U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris held a productive call on Monday about immigration, the U.S.-Mexico border, and the battle against COVID-19. A senior U.S. official said before the call that Washington was planning to send more COVID-19 vaccines to Mexico, potentially from multiple manufacturers, including Moderna and AstraZeneca. The official says the U.S. has already lent a few million vaccine doses to Mexico and would be sharing more with it than any other country, reflecting the importance it attached to the bilateral relationship. Authorities in West Africa have confirmed the region's first known case of Marburg virus after at least one person in Guinea died of the hemorrhagic fever disease. The World Health Organization said that efforts were underway to track down everyone who might have come into contact with the sick person. The Marburg case was reported in the same part of Guinea where the 2014 to 2016 Ebola epidemic started and ultimately killed at least 11,325 people. The two viruses belong to the same family, and both are spread through bodily fluids. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention warned on Monday against travel to Israel, France, Thailand, Iceland, and several other countries because of a rising number of COVID-19 in those cases. The CDC has been adding its highest level 4 COVID-19 level as cases spread around the globe. The United States added Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza, along with other places, including Aruba and French Polynesia. In July, the CDC had raised concerns about Israel and the Palestinian territories, lifting its travel health notice by 2 levels to level 3. The CDC also hiked alert levels to level 3 for Austria, Croatia, El Salvador, Azerbaijan, Guam, Kenya, and Jamaica. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton, VOA News.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August the 10th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. Supporters of the Nigerian separatist group, the Indigenous People of Biafra, IPOB, began a weekly stay-at-home protest on Monday in the country's southeast, calling for their leader to be released.
There's a sense of hostility in the air. Very minimal movement in general. Everybody is just keeping to himself, just trying to just observe and see how everything pans out.
Mozambique's President Filipe Nyusi, on a visit to the troubled northern Cabo Delgado province, he unveiled the Southern African troops sent to fight the region's insurgents. And thousands of young Ghanaians mobilized via social media recently took to the streets of the capital, Accra. So, what are their demands?
They think in every aspect of their life, there is a place, there is something that ought to be fixed. So they were telling government that fix us because we want to see a better life.
Niama Ade with the Center for Social Justice in Accra. And UNICEF says that more than one in two children on the continent do not have a civil registration. We have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Stay tuned. And for our top story, supporters of the Nigerian separatist group, the Indigenous People of Biafra, IPOB, began a weekly stay-at-home protest on Monday in the country's southeast, calling for their leader to be released. Nigerian police arrested IPOB's Nnamdi Kanu in July and he's facing trial in October for treason. The stay-at-home protest is expected to shut down businesses, markets and schools in the region, where authorities have threatened to punish anyone who takes part. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
IPOB's southeast lockdown protest took effect from 6 a.m. local time on Monday and lasted 12 hours. Residents across many states in the region complied with the order to stay at home despite a warning from authorities prohibiting it. The separatist group says the protest is to press for the release of their leader, Nnamdi Kanu, who is facing trial for treason in Nigeria after he was rearrested in June. Enugu resident Daniel Ede said he received a memo from his office asking him to stay away from work on Monday.
There's a sense of hostility in the air. There's very minimal vehicular movements, very minimal movement in general. Everybody's just keeping to himself, just trying to just observe and see how everything pans out.
Enugu State in southeastern Nigeria is a strong base for the separatist movement. The separatist group says the stay-at-home protest will continue every Monday until Kanu is freed. In May, IPOB gave a similar order to honor fighters who died facing the Nigerian state during the civil war in the late 1960s. Imo State resident Justin Ohanu said travelers from Lagos passing through the state were hindered by local militias enforcing the lockdown.
This morning, some buses were burnt along the road there, and these buses were coming from Lagos. I think they got the passengers out of the vehicles, and they were transport buses, and about three of them got burnt.
Government offices in the region opened Monday, even though many workers could not make it to work due to movement restrictions. In January, IPOB launched an armed unit called the Eastern Security Network, or ESN. The government's crackdown on the unit escalated security tensions in the region and led to 115 extrajudicial executions, according to Amnesty International. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Mozambique's President Filipe Nyusi, on a visit to the troubled North Cabo Delgado province on Monday, welcomed Southern African troops sent to fight the region's insurgents. The Southern African Development Community's standby force includes troops from Angola, Botswana, Lesotho, South Africa, and Tanzania. The SADC troops are being deployed as Mozambican and Rwandan troops on Sunday say they retook a key port city that the Islamist militants held for 2 years. Charles Mangwiro reports from Maputo.
In a live broadcast on state radio and television Monday from Cabo Delgado's provincial capital, Pemba, President Filipe Nyusi addressed Southern African troops deployed to the region to fight insurgents. Southern African Development Community members Angola, Botswana, Lesotho, South Africa, and Tanzania are the first in the 16-member group to send troops to Mozambique. Nyusi thanked the SADC for its engagement and underscored the need to coordinate in battling the Islamist militants.
Os ataques terroristas na província de Cabo Delgado, não só contra Moçambique.
To the sad extent by forces who are here, he says, we appeal once again for greater coordination on the operational theater and rigorous observation of the benchmarks of responsibility strategically defined. Nyusi says they demand communication, exchange of operative information on the ground, discipline and respect for human life. The total number of soldiers the group is sending to Mozambique has not been made public, but experts from SADC, who in Cabo Delgado, suggested the mission should comprise around 3,000 troops. Botswana, in late July, announced it was sending almost 300 troops to fight in Mozambique, and its president, Mokgweetsi Masisi, attended Monday's unveiling. The commander of the SADC standby force is South African Major General Ngolani Mankai. Speaking on state broadcaster from Pemba, he said they will do everything possible to restore peace in the affected areas.
The strategic end state, as described above, is to facilitate the creation of a secure environment to ensure that the state authorities is in full control of the Cabo Delgado affected areas and normal lives can resume.
Nyusi had been reluctant to allow foreign troops into Mozambique's conflict, but in July confirmed the outside help was needed to defeat the insurgents. Rwanda, which is not a SADC member, sent 1,000 troops in early July to Cabo Delgado, where they say they are making gains fighting alongside Mozambique's. Spokesman for Mozambique's Minister of Defense, Omar Saranga, late Sunday announced they had regained control of the port town of Mocimboa da Praia.
Neste momento, as operações continuam na vila de Mocimboa da Praia com o objetivo de...
He says it is important to highlight that the success of the operation is due to the effective collaboration of the local communities, which is why they call for reinforcement of collective vigilance. Bear in mind, says Saranga, that due to the push for the ongoing offensive, terrorists will tend to infiltrate with the aim of disrupting searches as well as registration of rescued populations. The ministry said insurgents who call themselves Al-Shabaab but are not connected to the Somali Islamist group of the same name had controlled the port for more than 2 years. Since the insurgents began fighting in 2017 near rich oil and gas deposit projects, more than 2,500 people have been killed. More than 800,000 have been displaced by the fighting since April 2020, while gas projects worth billions have been put on hold. Charles Mangwiro for VOA News, Maputo, Mozambique.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Thousands of young Ghanaians recently took to the streets of the capital, Accra, to protest what they say is increasing insecurity and lawlessness in the country and the need for urgent economic reforms. The peaceful march was held on Ghana's founding day and delivered a petition to the offices of the President and the Speaker of Parliament calling on the government of President Akufo-Addo to introduce reforms that give true meaning to the country's independence. Protesters mobilized mainly online via popular social media platforms, especially Twitter, with the hashtag #FixTheCountry trending in Ghana and elsewhere. Ni Ama Ade is an educator with the Center for Social Justice in Accra. He tells me that the protests were fueled by the feeling among young Ghanaians that the government was out of touch with the needs of the majority of the population and that it's not living up to the promises laid out by the country's founding fathers.
So let's say 71% of the Ghanaian population are youth under 35 years. And they feel that you have a leadership that is so old that they are not in touch with the needs of the youth. So they drum in home their consents and their voice to say that we constitute the majority, yet we don't see what leadership is doing to ameliorate the difficulties, the seeming challenges of the youth, which they outline as employment, outdated 1992 constitution, which gives so much power to the executive, which is the president, must be amended to see less power in the hands of the executive. And they also talk about unemployment, poor infrastructure development of the country. So hospitals, schools under trees.
Are these issues that have been exacerbated by the onset of the COVID-19 global pandemic and how Ghana has been specifically been impacted, especially Ghanaian youth?
I mean, COVID has had its challenges, but the micro, which is the internal affairs of the country, if dependent on itself, should not feel the impact so much because, I mean, look at the infected rates, look at the death levels, they are negligible.
Now, the current government in power, the government of Akufo-Addo, it is early on in his second term. Is it too early to expect that he will achieve some of these demands that the youth are asking of his government?
Let me establish the point that the demand for the convenience of Fix the Country is not specifically against this government. Even though it is coming at this time and gives the impression that the current leadership is not doing as expected, but they outline that successive governments post-independence, I mean, apart from Nkrumah, who they separated, has not done so much for them. If you listen to the manifesto, the reason for which the current government was voted massively into power in their first term was because of the promises that they made to Ghana. They gave so much hope and people had so much expectation.
What is it about, what is Founders Day in Ghana and why was this march held on that specific day?
Okay, so this Founders Day was instituted by the president, Nana Akufo-Addo's government. And the aim is to honor what we call in Ghana the Big Six, the founders of our independence, led by Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. So Founders Day is to celebrate these founders of our independence. So the significance of this date for the conveners and the massive youth who went onto the street was to say that what they saw their founders did after independence is not the same as they say now.
So that the government has not lived up to the expectations of the founding fathers.
Exactly what the conveners are saying, yes.
Okay, now this march was largely driven by social media with a trending hashtag. Is this the first march of its kind organized primarily through online mobilization?
Yes, I would say so. It started as an online movement with the hashtag Fix the Country. At its early stages, when the hashtag was launched, they were able to receive 8 million tweets from Ghanaians all over the world. I mean, the issues raised from the over 8 million Ghanaians who tweeted and got onto social media embodies around the whole aspect of life, which tells you that they think in every aspect of their lives, there is a place, there is something that ought to be fixed. So they were telling government that fix us because we want to see a better life.
Niama Ade is an educator with the Center for Social Justice in Accra. I reached him at home in Accra, Ghana. The mining industry has long been one of South Africa's largest sectors, but women are still a minority in its workforce. Now, a group called Women in Mining South Africa is trying to change that through a mentorship program to help young women enter the field. For VOA, Linda Giftash reports from Johannesburg.
Bailey Sabetlele is a geologist for Harmony Gold Mining. Mining seemed a natural career choice for the 29-year-old with interests in science and exploration. But with women making up less than 15% of the country's mining workforce, fitting in did not come easily. She recalls the first day without her male supervisor by her side.
I had to go underground on my own, do the actual work. I got this other man telling me that, no, Bailey, we're not going to listen to you. You're young enough to be my daughter or my granddaughter, so I'm not going to listen to you.
6 years into her career, Sebetlele says she's built trust with her male colleagues, but the path could have been easier with more support. That's why the nonprofit Women in Mining South Africa launched a mentorship program for 42 young women, including Sebetlele, this year. Raksha Naidu is the deputy chairperson.
It can become a very lonely journey when you're in these very, very male-dominated industries, and without having some sort of support or guidance, it can force you to leave the industry a lot quicker than you should. So there was definitely a need for mentorship.
Mining has long been a male-dominated industry in South Africa. Women could not legally work underground until 1996. An employer organization called Minerals Council South Africa took a survey about work conditions in the industry. Tatula Balfour, head of health at the council, says the survey revealed barriers facing women.
Although it was generally positive, there were still comments around issues of inadequate physical infrastructure, things like those unisex toilets, and again, PPE, which is suited for women.
PPE stands for personal protective equipment. Sepet Lele says it's also difficult to find work boots small enough to wear. The Minerals Council says companies are adapting equipment and the environment to ensure women's safety and comfort on the job. Naidu says women in mining is also trying to boost the number of women in the industry by providing career booklets to schools about the many diverse jobs that do not require work underground.
Young girls as early as probably grade 8 or 9 will start seeing what these different faces look like and these different careers look like so that they're able to understand the subjects that they need to take at school. And people are starting to see that it's not just about putting on a hard hat and overalls.
For Sepet Lele, having a female mentor to talk to through the daily challenges at work has made a difference. As she sets her ambitions higher, Sepet Lele says seeing other women advance in the sector is encouraging.
In our corporate office, now with the new appointments, you're seeing women, you're starting to see women occupying those strategic positions. You're starting to see young women taking up space. So I think any young woman can do it with the right guidance and with the right mindset as well.
Positive feedback from this year's protégés has Women in Mining planning to expand its program. The organization is looking to establish a mentorship program for mid-career women who want to climb the corporate ladder. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And let's go to East Africa in Uganda, where police have preferred 15 cases against the popular Turkey-based blogger and political activist Fred Kajubi, popularly known by his social media name Lumbuye. Uganda police spokesman Fred Enanga says the charges include spreading harmful information and inciting the public to use improvised explosive devices, IEDs. He's also being accused of acts considered as subversive against the government. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarenji has more from Kampala, Uganda.
Ugandan controversial blogger and activist Fred Kajubi, also known as Lumbuye, is said to have been arrested by Turkish authorities over the weekend on what he said to be immigration-related crimes. Uganda police spokesman Fred Enanga told journalists this Monday that Lumbuye will be charged for inciting the public against an established government, among other crimes.
We do have about 15 case files against Fred Kajubi Lumbuye that are under investigation surrounding acts of spreading harmful information or propaganda, sharing videos inciting the public to protest using IEDs, that is improvised explosive devices, to incite chaos in the public, and other cyber crimes.
Lumbuye came to prominence for criticizing the current government and subscribes to Robert Chagrani, Bobi Wine's party, the National Unity Platform, or NUP. And more recently in June, he claimed in his social media posts that Uganda's president, Yoweri Kaguta Museveni, had died, prompting the president to ask police to arrest bloggers like him. Okello Oryem, Uganda Foreign Affairs Minister, said this past weekend that Uganda was working with Turkish authorities to have Lumbuye extradited to Uganda.
You got a special person. Who is he to think that he can get to be above the law, irrespective of where he is? The law is very clear in all countries. You break the law, you pay the penalty. So if he broke the law, let him pay the price. And I would have thought that every single one of you would be jubilating, celebrating that this person who committed the crime is being arrested and is being brought before the court of law. But now it seems you're sympathizing with.
But Jacob Osiminyu, the spokesperson for the immigration, said this Monday that Lumbuye is not yet in the country.
I do not have any information pertaining the arrival or entry of Lumbuye. When we get it, we shall let you know. Or when we get him, we shall let you know.
NUP lawyer and politician Nkonyingi Mwada says Uganda government has an obligation to state the whereabouts of the controversial blogger. Nkunyinji says the government must treat Lumbuye as an innocent person until proven guilty by competent and impartial courts. He says NUP is looking for international lawyers to represent Lumbuye.
And also keep up international legal pressure and look into a number of international legal remedies. And locally here, we have also aligned teams of standby lawyers. We are putting government to task that in case by any way, legal or illegal, they succeed to deport Lumbuye, he must be accorded his full rights because we fear for his life.
It is not clear if Uganda has an extradition treaty with Turkey, a legal instrument required for Lumbuye to be extradited to Uganda. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji, Kampala, Uganda.
More than one in two children in Africa do not have a civil registration. That's according to UNICEF. August 10th is the African Day for Civil Registration and Vital Statistics. And UNICEF West and Central Africa's Child Protection Specialist, Cecile Modova, spoke to Ricky Shryok about obstacles to registration and many more.
Among the obstacles or challenges to improve the registration rate is the fact that birth registration, first of all, is not a service that is free of charge in most of the countries. Actually, the population has to pay, although it's supposed to be a universal service. Then secondly, I would highlight the distance for the population to actually reach the registration offices. Very often, services are not decentralized, so people have to actually face quite a lot of travel time to reach the registration office. Then often for the population in more rural areas, the actual immediate benefits of birth registration might not be so evident. So it might also be a question of priority for the beneficiaries. And yeah, there are numerous challenges, obviously, but also maybe highlight that the current pandemic that the world is facing has also further challenge the situation due to the disruption of services in many places.
So we talk about the obstacles, but why is it important, given especially all the obstacles, to register children? And what kind of impact does not registering have on communities and families?
When you look at the consequences of not being registered, those are quite dramatic from different perspectives. First of all, it really doesn't give you any legal existence towards the society or towards government. Children who are not registered, in the eyes of the state, they literally don't exist. So they're never counted in any ways. And they might face serious obstacles and challenges in accessing services of different kinds, including education. So there is a direct connection between dropout from school and lack of birth registration, simply because when children reach the age of passing official exams, they need to show a proof of identity. And if they cannot do so, then they simply will never be able to pass the exam. So it's a factor that actually, you know, influences on children's and students' motivation to prioritize education. So that's one important one. And then there are other also very dramatic consequences when you look at children's chances of being subject to exploitation, such as child marriage or child labor, just because they don't have a proof of age. And then there are also consequences in terms of the government's ability to actually plan for their citizens.
Can you tell me about the effectiveness of removing fees for birth registration and how that is demonstrated? I believe, according to UNICEF, by countries like Cape Verde and Congo Brazzaville.
When a service that very often, as I said, doesn't have any immediate benefit for the population, then when they're on the top of it, there it has a cost, that becomes very challenging for population groups that are already facing, you know, numerous challenges to survive the day. And then there are a series of other measures that need to be taken, you know, most importantly, to ensure that the services are available at the most decentralized level so that travel time is reduced.
That is UNICEF's Cecile Modova speaking to VOA's Ricky Shryok. And that's it for this Tuesday, August the 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Ricky Shryok, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good day, Africa.
Stay informed and up to date Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC with VOA's International Edition. Our correspondents bring you the news from around the globe, plus we delve into the context of the day's biggest stories with interviews with experts that place the story into context to understand why it matters. VOA's International Edition, your best source for news and information.